You're right, you're right.
That's to make sure not.
That gives us the opening for what we haven't had time to write yet. I mean, the next thing is, well, aren't you just saying that this will turn into jogging en masse and biopower of all sorts of forms? And that gets us back to the question of biopower, which is the most fundamental question, which would one would think would subsume and distort any of these remaining practices. Well, the first thing to say is that the only hope for them not being subsumed and distorted is that they stay not important enough to be. For the time being, they're safe as long as they're trivial and marginal. Right? Yeah.
And there's the one other step, which is when we said in the one of the interviews, this all sounds like Berkeley. And he said, well, no, not at all, because in Berkeley everyone thinks that what they're doing is both scientifically based in terms of health and is good for everybody. So jogging en masse might happen, but it wouldn't be the way, it's not the beta breakers.
But he's given us the transition to the next section in a way that we didn't have it before. Because the answer goes something like, well, they're safe as long as they're marginal. But if we focus them in a new ethics of the self, they wouldn't be safe anymore. They'd be gobbled up by biopower. So the real problem, as we said all along, is normalizing in biopower.
I think they're already being gobbled up by biopower. Yeah. I mean, if you use jogging as an example, I don't know how marginal.
No, we wouldn't. I mean, jogging is already not marginal.
Yeah,
I mean,
not
no.
At all. Fitness is so getting more and more important.
Right, right. Well, fitness is not what we're for. Not in our list, fitness wasn't one. We'll see why. We had friendship, temperance, or sports. Maybe we should get rid of sports
again is the amateur ideal in sports, which has been almost totally destroyed now by the
amateur sports?
Suburbanization of American culture. Nonetheless, it's still there. What's wrong with it, presumably, is the best medical psychiatric establishment that's grown up around it on the one hand, and the fact that people are doing it, they think, so that they won't have heart attacks, so that all those kind of things. But to jog presumably a la Greek gymnasia because you want to be in the company of your friends on a nice afternoon, and for no other end than that, that's nothing wrong with that.
You should make that clear.
Yes,
that
we have another word.
Your life is better directed to medieval Christians than us.
Yeah, we should get rid of sports and exercise. Both those words seem sort of contaminated.
Unless you clarify, because even beautiful bodies, you know,
right.
We're not anorexia, you know.
Yeah. In every case, it's going to be, it's hard to separate the aesthetic dimension from health.
That's right, as it was for the Greeks, one might add.
That's what we're going to go on to. Let's try going on. So you're absolutely right. This new idea of an ethical substance based on these other practices it will immediately, once it stops being trivial and marginal and tries to be central, get pulled into the normalizing and biopower health thing. So the only hope would finally be to go back and do a genealogy of health and biopower and show how, try to loosen that grip on us. You can't stop just by trying to loosen the hermeneutic self grip on us and substitute a new self. That's the transition we're really...
Friendship too, by the way, affirming that there's now friendship specialists.
Psychological
health. That's right, psychological health. It says you need friends in order to stay psychologically healthy.
All this stuff is really old hat because in the late 19th century in America, you have kinds of anti-modernist aesthetic tendencies that we're talking about even today.
Yeah.
Revival of craft ideal, revival of martial virtue.
The trick is
revival of traditional forms of commitment. Whatever.
The trick is how to make this postmodernist.
And all that word already gobbled up.
Yeah, sure.
It's already gobbled up.
Sure.
So what we see here in our culture is forms of anti-modernism that has been ironically and paradoxically made more consistent with rationalized culture.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, initially, historically, in the late 19th century, those forms of things were reactions to rationalized culture.
Okay, but if you don't react deeply enough, if you don't call into question first the picture of ourselves as a meaningful subject, it's going to somehow get gobbled up by that. Or if you call that into question and don't call into question biopower, it's still going to get gobbled up by that. So Foucault has to there's a lot of deconstructing that needs to be done before they can just simply be introduced. And we're not saying that they should simply be introduced. We've got to make that clear. We're saying that they provide the elements of a new possible way of life, like the new economy of bodies and pleasures, which would only be possible once our current understanding of reality had been so weakened by, I don't know, either Foucauldian criticism or misery or both.
And it's also hard to believe that these fragmentary things are anywhere near enough to constitute, to make basic changes in the whole society and culture. These are a few marginal things lying around that we've been able to talk about. He doesn't talk about anything.
Not that they're supposed to make basic changes. I mean, that isn't even our claim. That what you want to say is they're not enough to put together a new paradigm of how to be a human being and what the culture is all about. If we could get rid of the one we've got. Yeah. But there's some of the elements that you would have left to put that together. He's got his piece, namely a new ethical substance and an aesthetics of existence as a new kind of ethics, trying to have a beautiful life. That's one piece. We've got our pieces, namely these marginalized practices that were once important in the Greeks but trivialized by the Christians. Those are both, that's all pieces of the new economy of bodies and pleasures, which couldn't even have a chance if our current way of looking at things wasn't wiped out first. Is that all?
But you're quite right that the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century was the last period in which on the one hand, dandyism, but on the other hand, the beautiful life, the life, you know, this was also Berkeley, the dressing in togas at the Greek theater and making life into an aesthetic event, which was, you know, again, basically some form of high suburban culture. And it can't be that.
So it's not just an aesthetics of existence, it's an aesthetics of existence with a particular definition.
That's right.
That's so it's going to distinguish it from all the, Wagnerian tendency on people like that.
Sure.
That's right. And we have yet to ask him that question. We hope to get a chance somewhere.
But he's very clear in another paper on the Enlightenment, and then with the second section on modernism. He's very pro modernism. I mean, this can't be. And he has no intention of making it anti-modernist. So whether one wants to use postmodernist or not, I don't know. But it's clearly accepting the fact. I mean, the modernism, it's not a return to the Greeks. He's absolutely adamant about that. So it's somehow, where do we go from here, given everything that is, and given our analysis, his analysis of the dangers
of modernism. He's advocating a new form of expressivism, right? That's no longer rooted.
But there's nothing to express.
No longer rooted in the deep self. That's
for sure.
That's right.
For sure.
You got to deconstruct the deep self.
Right.
You still will have selves. And some
right.
Other
sure. Right. Yeah. Right.
That's why what Bersani said at the beginning of the lecture is radically wrong.
Huh? What?
Well, this is no way a radicalized anarchy which seeks to disperse the self.
Right. Right.
It's quite
absolutely
the opposite. It seeks to focus the self.
Right.
The self
in a new form of self mastery.
Deeper. Form of a combination of pleasure and austerity into a well-formed aesthetic and ethical character.
Those of you in been in Nahamas' seminar, any of you go to his Nietzsche seminar? This seems very, very close to Nietzsche, who had an idea of the self as a work of art and having a unifying, the only thing that unified it was the style, and that what mattered was that it have a unified style. It didn't matter what the self did. Or which part of the self did it, as long as it was together like a work of art. Sounds very similar to that.
But how would reciprocity get worked into that?
Good question.
Well, he seems to think that certainly one of the things we can learn from the Greeks is the horrors of culture and society built on non-reciprocity. And so the reciprocity of pleasure and desire on the one hand, and or the reciprocity would be a foundation point for these other scattered things that we've isolated. It just seems like a given for him.
Well, how about this? I mean, I don't think anybody said this yet, but we've sort of hinted at it. I mean, for Nietzsche, it's as if each person is a work of art all of their own. But that's not really how works of art are. They're all variations on a shared common aesthetic style at any given period. And one of the things we hope would save it from sort of dandyism and idiosyncrasy, well, not dandyism, unfortunately, but save it from non-reciprocity, everybody going off on their own, is just to push this art thing even further and say there would be sort of shared style. Is that right? We don't know.
No.
There's a problem, it's a double problem. One is about this issue of the self and self-mastery. I don't think it can be self-mastery because that replicates the problem in a more intense form. Anything that retains this notion of the master within the self is a problem for me, anyway. Mm. I was thinking about this terrible Beck's question as well.
I'm not sure he agrees with that, but that we should ask him.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he does, but that's one of my... There's another issue, this Beck's issue of the tradition and how it becomes a tradition. Well, that's it. I think that the Greco-Roman, this Greco-Roman non-reciprocal horrible elite world has become our tradition, and that is the problem, that we have incorporated it in different forms with elaborations down through these things until what was purely a tiny elite version of how to live in the world has become available and enforced and imposed indeed on the mass. And that may be part of the problem of this relation between the self and self-mastery and a kind of historic development of a tradition that actually creates itself as a tradition through that history. Now why I'm saying all that is because something in the last few pages you've read, on one level is a very simple problem, it would be the Oxford philosopher's problem about what is this reality? How can you have this thing of a reality which he writes about, which can still overlook, if he's writing about what's really real, or the real, how can he overlook what precedes, accompanies, and survives?
Well, you can answer that.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I don't even know how to answer to it. It seems to me that's what you do, provided maybe we just have to get one thing clear, that what the real means in this is what counts it real as real in a kind of changing history of what counts as real, not what the Oxford philosopher thinks of as sort of what's really real all along. And so there's this changing understanding, this Hegelian changing understanding of what counts as real. And whenever any given thing counts as real, then philosophers tell you what is really human. According to that standard, say Kant, what's really human is the universal moral law within, and everything else just gets thrown out, like in Kant, feelings, which mm-hmm. don't count. Mm-hmm. So now, is that an answer?
Yeah, it is an answer, but it then gets on to the next question. If you're characterizing what it does as that, with a kind of temporalized real mm-hmm. that shifts, do you run the risk of turning him into a kind of realist, a realist historian, like a realist novel, we get the realist historian, which would actually...
Yeah, as long as you take the real as this absolute historical construct. Yeah, like he said earlier, that he's a happy positivist, in a certain kind of way, he's a happy historical ontologist. What people at various points systematically took to be the real was the real.
I think that's right. I mean, that's like... In that way, he's like Heidegger and like Hegel.
Is that why he said he had a correspondence theory of truth?
Well,
did he say that?
Yeah.
He said that to your student there.
To Keith.
Yeah.
Well, who knows? I think he does have a correspondence theory about science. I think he really thinks that science got it right and therefore broke out of the whole history of understandings of reality and out of the power-knowledge complex, and is now just telling us how it is with the quarks. I think he really believed that, and so does Charles Taylor. It's somehow something somebody can believe while being otherwise totally Hegelian.
Well, remember we went through this because not Hegelian. But
no, anyway, for this discussion, it would be all right. I understand it now. There are lots of reasons why it's not.
But before we get off the track, just do us the favor of I mean, so far does it seem to... We're under enormous time pressure, so that's why we're imposing this on you. There's so many issues involved, as you can see, we're still in the process of sorting them out. Does this seem to stick together? I mean, the fact that there are a million implications to it is great. I mean, and it's something to think about in the next few years. But, I mean, does the distinction about types of archaeology, the relation of those archaeologies to genealogy, to interpretive analytics, to these peripheral practices, to the fact that Foucault has seen that he's isolated a problem, as he says, but not a set of solutions, but doesn't in fact have any way to even point at the solutions, even though we think that elements of them must be available. And the reason he can't do that is because of this question of the real and systematicity. And what am I leaving out?
Well, you're leaving out that he thinks that somehow discovering this other ethical substance in our own tradition is important, but he can't give any, that's what started us on this, he can't give any account of why it's important. It might as well be the Ars Erotica as far as we can see, given his inability.
Well, he thinks, I mean, it came out in the interview that it's more striking when
right, but that's pretty weak. Yeah, why is it more striking? And is that just all, just that it's a little, that it's more striking? And that's where we start.
See, Foucault agrees that there's something important about the fact that there is within Western history, there is a set of a very different ethical system. There's something important about that, as opposed to the anthropological move that among human beings there are other ethical systems. He agrees that there is something important, that it's within our tradition. But why it's important, he has nothing to say about. And it's one of the things that we're struggling with about trying to articulate why it's important. About why the fact that it's in our tradition makes it important.
That seems clear at the end when you're talking about just kind of marginalized practices. But when you first mentioned it and talked about changing cultural garb or something, uh-huh. It seemed a little bit more awkward there. As if, I mean, it sounded like a move back to Greek culture wasn't problematic. I don't remember exactly.
Well, then it sounded like we could jump into something that was in our cultural skin, but I thought we said right away before or after that it isn't the golden age and we couldn't do it. That's what we have to keep saying at the same time.
I'll keep that in mind.
I
think
that.
But
I think I mean, if you make some allusion to this, to
these
marginal practices or something.
Sure.
But I think I mentioned the thing on the reel because it just sort of, I couldn't really articulate it. It's a bit hard to hear something like that.
Sure, it's pretty good.
But I was going to suggest to you that as you go on, that might come back and hit you somewhere.
Yep.
When you get around the corner, suddenly it's
sure.
going to be there. Like,
no, it's good.
There's a problem that's got to be resolved.
This is also going to come, is not an excuse, an explanation. After a fair amount in the interviews about historical ontology and what he means about historical ontology now, and three axes of historical ontology, truth.
How can you do it?
Truth, power, and ethics. And
these books are all on the ethics.
These are
axis.
The ethics axis. But clearly put together, that's a fairly complete historical ontology.
Meaning the categories for describing what counts as reality at any given period will have to tell you what counts as true, what counts as selves, and what counts as power? Is that the last one?
That's the middle one.
The first one is true. So they'll have to tell you what counts as true, how power is, I call it a disciplinary power or monarchical power, and what kind of selves do you have. And if you answer those three questions, you will say something like, what counts as real in the human world, because never mind science, at any given period.
And that's all you can say about ontology.
All he wants to say about it anyway. I mean, there's something to say about science, but he doesn't care.
No. Right. But I mean, you can't. That's the answer to the Oxford philosopher, too. Language is just that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. We could go on now.
Yeah.
And try to show, because you've given us this transition. Go ahead first.
I just wanted to ask what happened to the annexing of norms, rationality.
Aha! Well, how, that's just what I meant to say when I said we could go on. Okay. Now, you've given us. Giving us the transition, right?
Normalization.
You've given us a transition, which is that it doesn't do much good to get a different ethical substance, think of selves in a different way, bring in all these marginalized practices and make them central again in some way in a new economy of bodies and pleasures, if you haven't faced and genealogized and deconstructed biopower, which means all of this being used for normalization and welfare. And oddly enough, we want to say, Foucault seems to have lost sight of that project for the time being anyway, either because this other one is so fascinating or so timely or that one is so hard. But if you didn't lose sight of it, what would you have to do? And we're going to try to construct ahead now from beyond these three books. One, he's got a lot of material. Well, let me put it motivated another way. First, you need a genealogy of biopower that traces it back to the Greeks, too. Right now, it just seems to start in an arbitrary way in the Enlightenment. And lo and behold, Paul particularly spotted constant signs of biopower in the Greeks. When in the interviews, Foucault talks about how pleasure is subordinate to health, and how the doctors are always telling them not to have too much sexual pleasure because it'll wear them out and be bad for their health. And they're all concerned about food, but they're not concerned about making it taste good, Foucault says, but what season you should eat what in order to be healthy and what season you shouldn't eat what. In general, it looks like they were obsessed with individual health. We don't have any clues, apparently, about whether they were obsessed with social health. It doesn't.
He doesn't have a word about it. No. We intend to ask him.
Right. Okay. If we get a chance, we'll ask him. But in any case, at least individual health. So it looks like there is something to be said about the genealogy of biopower. We'll clear back to the Greeks.
And the words even in Greek,
Where
the telos of this life are techne to bio. I mean, if that's not biopower, then what the hell is biopower?
A technique on life.
And he just doesn't see that. He just looks blank.
So Paul wants to say that the technique on life becomes the technology for enhancing life. And
which it already does.
This radical emergence of the category of life. You know, the order of things. It's not life in the same sense.
No. But just as...
and it's not technology in the same sense.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all, but it's a genealogy. It's something which was there that could be co-opted in the Enlightenment and given a new form and a new direction.
Intensified and expanded and amplified and elaborated. But to somehow think genealogically, it comes out of nowhere, or only the Roman army camps or something, seems so obviously wrong. But he's just not thinking in those terms right now.
It isn't clear to me why it'll help us any to realize that it goes clear back. That's a good question. I mean, why is it important to notice that our biopower has a longer genealogical history than we thought, and that there were dangers already in the Greek?
Oh, because I think there seems a kind of strange elaboration that, as John said, this dandyism and many of the, at least surface things that Foucault seems to be talking about, have been throughout the 20th century very alive and present and have been part of some parts of fascist movements in some way or other. We can talk about that in a minute. But that this obsession with health seems to be a whole, I mean, Foucault thinks the main thing wrong with the Greeks is non-reciprocity.
Right, right.
But it really also seems clear that this obsession with health above all else, and bodily health, also is something which was picked up and given an enormous importance in our culture.
Okay, right, but here's an interesting question. The way genealogy operates its deconstructing power is to show you how things might have been otherwise. That is, the genealogy of this Christian desire thing says, look at this, all of a sudden these Christians got obsessed with desire, there was a whole tradition when it was otherwise, might be otherwise again. This funny genealogy says, as far back as you can look in our tradition, people have been obsessed with health.
So it can't make a difference. There's no difference.
Right, and therefore, this genealogy seems only sort of to be digging us in deeper instead of helping us get out.
Thing, saying, going back to saying the Greeks shows that we were always obsessed with ourselves. That's a very different kind of obsession.
Well, if it were a good kind, if we could say, but we can't. Well, the Greeks offer us an alternative to biopower in that they also thought life was important, but they weren't obsessed with health. That would be great, but what it looks like is that they offer us not an alternative to biopower, but the beginning of biopower.
But you know what you'd have to do? Excuse me, David, to do that?
Go back to Homer,
yeah.
Which is just what he doesn't want to do,
yeah.
But he would.
That's what
I put this on the record, yes, Paul said, well, then you'll at some point in the discussion, well, then we'll have to go back to see what's behind that. And it's true, in Homer, life was certainly not...
Arete and honor were certainly higher than hell.
Well, and life was something that was not... And the way they looked at being alive was a question of having the power to do these great deeds and so forth. And the Bible said the other way around, it didn't seem that they were obsessed with diets and with the frequency of sex, and they shouldn't tire themselves out too much in these exploits in Homer's time. Now that does seem to be...
And there's no culture of the self. I mean, I think that would say that categorically. There's no notion of the self in Homer.
And
so
friendship,
we don't want to go back.
And friendship is very central.
Very, very central.
Why
I forgot about that.
Back?
He just sort of sighed. It seems to me only that he's already gone back to a whole volume that he didn't expect to do on Greek aphrodisia, which he thought he was going to start with Christians, after one chapter on the Greeks. And he's got two new volumes that he didn't expect to write, the Greek Techniques of Self-Mastery volume and the Greek View About Sex Acts volume. And now we tell him that, look, you've got to get it back to the Homeric.
And not to mention the Hebrews.
And of course, I was just going to say, and not to mention that there's a whole strain in our tradition that is as if it didn't exist when he writes. But I don't know whether that's going to help us any, get over biopower. But then the other little...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yep.
I thought biopower became interesting when we began talking about it in terms of our relationship to positivistic objective quantum science and government relationship to health, not just obsessing about health.
Right, I was going to talk about that right next. That's what I was starting to say.
The
exactly. Yeah. We've got to get back to the norms. Now, what we want to say about the norms is that you can't do a good job of getting us to see what biopower is so that we can then see that it doesn't have to be that way, which is always the basic job to keep in mind, if you don't see what's particularly wrong with biopower. And he doesn't seem to want to see something which seems obvious to some of us anyway, that what's wrong is that the norms have this peculiar relation to theory and to systematicity, so that everything is constantly being drawn in to and harmonized with and turned into a science of whatever it is that comes into our norms. And now we want to say that again, that that's already beginning in the Greeks with their, we don't know much to say about this now, I'm getting out on a limb, but well, let's begin at the beginning. If there is something wrong with our norms because they are systematic and theoretical, Foucault is not likely to see it because he thinks that sort of system and theory is what everything he studies is always a system and a theory, according to him.
He studies the real, and the real is only, by definition, a current system. And therefore, to say that it's systematic or theoretical and is just a given for him.
So when we say our norms are like that, he says, well, that can't be the problem. That's how norms always are. Now, but we did want to say, walking over here, it seemed, and then I said something like, but the Greeks, were they systematic and theoretical too in their norms in the same way we are with this kind of scientific rationality or not? Sometimes it looks like they were already the source of our kinds of
Well, he says norms. No. He said, and there are two steps there. He says no, Aristotle and systematic knowledge is a great exception.
Right.
And it's not typical of Greek culture at all.
Right.
It just happens to be what we've picked out of Greek culture.
Right. That's
because we're so interested in that kind of knowledge and systematization.
Mm-hmm.
And two, the systematic part, theoretical part, is only half the story, because the other half of the story about normalization, which the Greeks didn't, whether or not they had theory, they certainly didn't have the second part, which is this imperial gobbling up of more and more and more realms, such that reality is seen as this ever-expanding domain, which constantly the norm has to normalize.
No, they certainly didn't.
They had a very different universe than that.
Right.
So
it's
two parts which go together, but you could have a system and a static system.
Right. I guess what we want to say is that.
You could have a static system, or even a moving system, but one which was rooted in static principles, like the cosmos or something.
Okay, that may be the Stoic stage.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, isn't there a substantial difference between justifying the systematicity in terms of tradition or a beautiful life or something like that, and saying, we must do this because it's normal, which seems to be characteristic of modern society, and that's also what makes it able to live.
No, wait, I don't think that's right, but put it on hold a second. Just 1 second, remind me of it. That you must do this because it's normal.
Well,
I want to say one more thing to finish what Paul said, because it's important for us. So then you might be able to find in the Greeks again, a parallel thing, that just as the practices are sick, so the reciprocity stuff, the non-reciprocity practices are sick, so the obsession with health is sick. But again, on the formal level, you might find some good alternative for us. Just as the ethical substance was different than our Christian obsession with desire, so their normalization was static and partial instead of being ongoing and so on and so on. But now he's put the main punchline for us. Until Foucault is ready to say what's wrong with our norms, namely that they are systematic and theoretical and scientifically rational, he can't go back and find in the Greeks a contrasting kind of norm.
Yeah.
And that's what we're criticizing him for
right
now. Now, but the point is the Greeks really did have a contrasting kind of norm, because what the essence of our norms isn't to say, because it's normal, you ought to do it. Every culture says that, explicitly and implicitly.
No, they don't say, because it's normal, you ought to do that. They say, because this is the way it's done or something, but normality, in that sense, is not an end in itself.
Normality is based on science.
Okay, there are two different kinds of normal. Not on tradition.
But normality is always an end in itself, in one sense. Namely, it's always a justification for telling somebody they ought to do something, that this is the way we've always done it, or this is the way we do it.
Then you're collapsing norm and the normal.
Right, okay. Okay, then if normal means something more than just norm, then it means not only is this the way we do it, but that the way we do it is grounded somehow. And this is not only the way we do it, but it's the way science shows that we ought to do it for our health, or God shows that we ought to do it for our salvation. And that's maybe where our society is peculiar, in trying to say that norms are normal, i.e. justifiable by something else than the claim that's how we do it.
We've got to do it, or the gods will make the volcano blow up.
I doubt if the Greeks even said that.
Because two things. One, it's continuously and self-consciously under examination, and two, the form of examination, the forms of public examination and therefore justification are the very way it expands.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that it's the relation to the normal rather than its groundedness that's characteristic.
How about my trying to put it together? Yeah, by thematizing the normal and making it a problem, and so that it isn't just a kind of taken for granted that you norm that people all do it the same way, and if you deviate, people will shake you back up, and you'll be glad they did. As soon as that becomes explicitly a problem,
they kill you.
Right. But as soon as it becomes a problem, why do you do it? Well, because it's normal, and why should I do what's, I mean, it's the norm, and why should I do what's the norm? At that moment, it also needs to be grounded. And when it, as soon as it becomes thematized, norms, they need to be grounded and become the normal. I would think they fit right together.
Why should you do it? Because it's the norm is a question that's always asked. I don't think that's unique to modern culture.
You're turning around now and giving me my line. Just a second.
No, presumably in Morocco, when some kid is taught how that he shouldn't eat pork. Why shouldn't he eat pork? Because that's what's in the Quran, and that's what it means to be a Muslim. That's the end of the discussion.
Right. As soon as you call it the norm, you reached a new level of thematization and self-consciousness. That is, you don't just say, now, we don't do it that way, but you consciously notice that cultures have norms, and this is our norm. And now you wonder, well, why this norm? And then you start trying to say it's for your health, or it's for some other... Does that make sense?
No, I just don't see the thing. I mean, it seems like you could say, well, because it's the norm, why is it the norm? Because it's the norm. I mean, I don't see why...
But that's the end of that. No, but the two are integrally related, because saying it's in the Quran stops the conversation, and if you go out during Ramadan, you're killed. That's it. You don't need anything else but that, as long as the, you know, roughly speaking, things work that way, and they do in many places. The next step is, though, why shouldn't I do whatever, you know, it is, eat pork or whatever, I don't know, let's think of an example. Because modern medicine tells us it has trichinosis, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And if you go on that level, or because latest find, you know, Margaret Mead has told us that the adolescents can be different, so there's no reason I should discipline my adolescents. But on the other hand, Derek Freeman says it really wasn't that way in Samoa. Well, should I raise my kids with et cetera, et cetera. Well, these studies show that it's better if you do this and you'll get into Harvard. And these studies show that if you get into Harvard, you're fucked up and blah, blah, blah. And it's the infinite.
Yeah, but all I was saying, it sounded like people were saying that some norms weren't grounded. I mean, that only in our society were norms grounded. I think it's what they're grounded in and therefore the relationship.
This is straight, that part is straight Weber. Their traditional authority grounds them in tradition, and that's by definition what it means that they're not self-consciously put up for examination and elaboration in the way that either bureaucratic or scientific rationality does. And the essence of how biopower operates is that it has both the being put up to question and the fact that any answer that's given, and this is what differentiates it from either tradition or modern religion, is itself, by definition, a provisional answer that has to continue to be questioned and to get finer and finer answers with more and more experts.
I'm still trying to put in a middle stage. Let me just try once more. As long as the first answer is, when you're asked why you should do it or shaped up is, that's what human beings do. And if you don't do it, you're going to get into trouble. To say instead that it's our norms is to produce another level of thematization already of self-consciousness. And as soon as you say that, instead of saying that's what human beings do, you leave it looking ungrounded. So that once you thematized it and said it's our norms, it looks terribly relativized and insecure, and now the question ought to be, well, why should I follow our norms? And then comes, well, no, but I don't believe that kind of conversation takes place. I mean, that's already much too sophisticated. If the level where Allah says so, it's human beings do that. And why should human beings do that?
No,
because Allah says so. The norm stuff seems very modern.
No, because all human beings are not Muslims.
That's why I disagree with you. I think that there is some kind of reference made to norms.
Well, I give up then. I vote. Okay.
Because trigonosis is the same thing as not as the gods will beat you up or whatever. It's the same thing. Whether you use the word trigonosis or the gods, it's the same meaning, right? You get beaten.
No.
I think there's so many people think too much in a lot of time.
But then a big moment that can be so, but then you can shift that in another 5 years and find that trigonosis cures cancer or something like that. And suddenly you're all going to eat pork.
That's right.
But that's the sort of shift temporarily you can get, which you won't get in the kind of God culture.
You seem to be saying that in order to...
We're talking about a cultural level here. We're not talking about individuals.
But you seem to be saying that to refer to a norm, you have to have an anthropological concept of culture or something. You have to have a modern notion of what a norm is.
Well, I do sort of think there's something like that, but I mean, until you get to be talking about norms, talking about norms is somehow, as norms, is somehow very sophisticated. It seems to represent a level beyond the way people just shape each other up, but I'm not sure. nobody agrees with this view, so I'm giving up on it.
That's Heidegger. I mean, that's...
No, I made it up. It's not Heidegger. Okay.
When you started out on all this this part about the norm, which I have problems with too, obviously, what were you going to say? What was your criticism of Foucault and something about the ancient world, something else with norms about the modern world?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was that? If you can remember.
Yeah. Okay. The criticism is that, which is the way we started this chapter again, that somehow the problems of deciphering the truth and the self, he's traced all the way back genealogically to the Christians and archaeologically to the Greeks, with this whole development that we have coming forward from that. We started off by saying there was this skewing going on there, which is presumably more than just simply biographical, that he's writing, happens to be writing these books at this point. And we're trying to locate that in the fact that the long genealogy, what we see is the more major problem than whether or not you're obsessed with yourself, is rooted, must be rooted in a number of different terms, one of which is centrally normalization. There's, and as he said in this room last week or whenever it was, normalization, the normal and norms are connected. But suddenly in the 17th century, and really not until towards the end of the 18th century does it really does the normal and then normalization reach a takeoff point conceptually. Presumably normalization in his story is happening throughout the 17th century, 18th century. It gets named a little bit later. The obvious question then is, why not relate that back? Where the hell did that come from? And how do we denaturalize that? And he seems blank on that.
Do you think he needs to go back that far to denaturalize it?
Well, that's partially what we're batting around now. I do, yeah.
First, he has to even thematize it. First, he has to say that it's not just the kind of norms that everybody has, that something special about it. And then he has to find a contrast. In our own tradition, is this story this right?
And imagine if there are things that are marginal.
It seems to leave the connection, again, I'm obsessed with this, but...
No, I'm telling you, go ahead.
We got this Christian culture for... 1600 years, you know, and before that, and suddenly in the Enlightenment we're starting to get secular culture again, which is the roots of biopower, the welfare state, reason, rationalization, all of that. Well, what was before the Christians was another pagan culture, in which all these things are on every page he writes. It seems like...
All these things, not all these things.
Not all these
not
things.
The
not normalization.
Which is interesting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say... Well, I said 2 weeks ago that I think that the norm and the normal don't actually exist before this period because nobody uses those terms. I think that's very important. This nominalist aspect is very important. And that the terms that are around before are terms like rule, regular, or to do with law, nomos, and all these sorts of terms. And looking at it just then, I was thinking that, well, yeah, I think now there are things that change in the 16th and 17th century and make it possible for this reciprocity to get going.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the norm and reciprocity are intimately related to the degree that you can't have norms without reciprocity.
Why couldn't you have hierarchical norms?
Because then they're rules. I mean, the second stage would not be norms that you believe, it would be the rule, like the rule of St. Benedict that says you can't do this because we say it in the rules.
Hmm.
Not because it's a norm that is distributed amongst the population at large, it says it in the rule, that's why you can't do it. So I'd make those distinctions.
Are you saying that
because they made them, I'd make them.
Are you saying rules are characteristic of hierarchical societies and norms characteristic of egalitarian societies?
No, not necessarily egalitarian, but reciprocal societies. The mass population society, or the population that's been transformed into
a set of
individuals.
Why aren't caste society a reciprocal society?
Ah, that's what I'm saying. Reciprocal in the sense of mass individuals
and
the relations that it talks about.
The
mediated
by rules, not by norms.
Yeah.
But it's also reciprocal society.
No, because it's not possible for everybody to change places.
It's not reciprocal.
No, it's not reciprocal. Yeah, I see.
It sounds like doom.
Can I say something? Let me try something. Norms don't have to be reciprocal, because surely there were norms at all times, for instance, which were what kings normally did, or what the aristocrats did what aristocrats normally do, and... slaves normally do. No, I agree that nobody used the term, but it wasn't. They didn't use the term rules either, did they? I mean, there was something that everybody knew was the way slaves were supposed to behave and the way that kings were supposed to behave.
Which gets you back instead of norms to.
No, but I was trying to make something about what you said, which struck me as really interesting. Once you get to normalization and you try to ground your norms in health, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Then they must be egalitarian, because the king's health and the mm-hmm. peasant's health are all health. So that at the point in which you graft your norms on theory, must also be the point in which you become completely egalitarian. Does that make any sense?
And I think that's the real location of the difference between the distinction we're trying to pull out of here, between like rationalization of norms. David Horne says, well, all traditional societies rationalize norms. I mean, Weber shows all traditional society rationalize norms. I mean, what's the difference between rationalization and norms and normalization? And I think it's normalization is what you're pointing to, is when norms get grafted onto nature and biology, and not just to rationalization and power.
So the Stoics grafted the norms onto the cosmos, and they were reciprocal. I mean, it seems to me a tight connection. You can't grasp the norms onto nature or the cosmos and health, and then have different norms for different classes. Different norms for different... you might have different norms for different genders, though, still, couldn't you? Uh-huh. Sure you could. I take it all back. You could have a whole medical science of how different, how the women ought to do that and the men ought to do that because it's for their good and so forth. So I take it completely back. It doesn't follow that once you ground your norms in the universal law or in science, that they have to be reciprocal and equalitarian norms.
It seems to me like there are two problems. One is that creating a new morality is not going to be, a new confession of self is not going to be sufficient given this. You're going to have to set up a new regime of truth and a new regime of power as well. And the second one seems to be that it's necessary to go back and do these genealogies, these other two historical ontologies. But are you going to get parallel sorts of marginal practices that are going to be of use to us from those kinds of genealogies? Is that the goal? I mean, is that...
I don't think so. No, what the goal is, never mind the content.
The goal simply denaturalizing?
The goal is, yes, the goal is two things. Denaturalizing our kinds of normalization by showing that there could be a society which had norms, but it wasn't normalizing. Whether we think that, I mean, I don't even know what it would be to look for the marginal practices that go with that. Do you have
In terms of truth and discourse, he has those strange things in the discourse and language about.
Oh, how the rhetoric people knew the truth was not the right function of language. That's a big jump, but maybe that's the kind of thing to look for. You gotta look for the kind of practices that fill in. You see, those would have to be really marginalized because we think the kind of practices that fill in the non-normalizing norms were already obsession with health and diet and stuff. So that it's again a case of the filling of the practices not being what you want, just as the non-reciprocity filling wasn't what you want, but it's the